I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we'll discuss a diabetes program that aims to drive down high rates of the disease in specific communities in Indianapolis. My guests are Dr. Lisa Staton, an associate professor at the Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI, Patrice Duckett, a community organizer, Tiffany Benjamin, Lilly Corporate Responsibility and Global Health Senior Director, and Eskenazi Nurse and Clinical Manager Alicia Jessup. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking today about a new program that aims to drive down high rates of diabetes in specific communities in Indianapolis. My guests are Dr. Lisa Staton, an associate professor at Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI, Patrice Duckett, a community organizer, Tiffany Benjamin, Senior Director of Corporate Responsibility and Global Health at Lilly, and Eskenazi Nurse and Clinical Manager Alicia Jessup. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. I'm going to invite our audience to join the conversation by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. And, you know, in the interest, because I've written about this in the past in other forum and all of that, I don't want the audience ever to think that I am withholding information. So I'm going to do my standard disclosure and say that I am, in fact, diabetic myself. So, you know, with some of what follows here, I will have more than a layman's knowledge of what we're talking about. So who would like to tell me about this new program and what it is? Okay, they're pointing at each other. This does not work well on radio,
so,
ladies.
I guess I'll give it a start and maybe Lisa can chime in as well. Okay. We're really excited to talk about the Diabetes Impact Project, which is really where we're focused on the treatment and prevention of diabetes in three neighborhoods here in Indianapolis, Northeast Side, Northwest, and Near West. What we know globally is that diabetes impacts 425 million people. And we know here in Indianapolis, we have a high prevalence and we have neighborhoods that I'm talking about where the prevalence is as high as 17.5%. So a lot of us in this community wanted to come together to see if there are ways to reduce the incidence of diabetes, but also help people with treatment. So us as Lilly, we decided to commit $7 million over 5 years to support community health workers to go into these communities. We're working with other partners like Eskenazi and IU Fairbanks School of Public Health to make sure that this is a scalable project that really has an impact on people in the community, but is driven by what the community needs and what the community feels is important to really address these important issues.
I'm going to say, when you say Northeast Side, Northwest Side, the third one was again?
It was Near West.
Near West Side. How are we doing? Can we put some boundaries on that? Because those are fairly generic. Some people's definition of Northeast Side might be different than others.
Okay, so the Northwest Side is my neighborhood, and that is from 16th Street to 38th Street to the north to White River to the west to the Highway 65 to the east. Okay. That is what we would consider Northwest area. The Near West area is on the other side of of White River, so White River to Tibbs Avenue over to Washington Street or a little bit further past Washington Street to the south. And 16th Street to the north.
Okay.
And then the Near East area is centralized by the 38th Street over to 46th Street from Keystone area up to roughly about Emerson. Yes.
Okay. So it's not as far. And that's part of the reason I wanted to ask that, because some people think of, you know, like Castleton as the northeast side. And why, I'll go with you, Lisa, why those areas in particular?
So as the conversation started about the possibility of doing this project, we were able to work with some local data through electronic medical records throughout the city and really plot out where the areas were that there were the highest rates of diabetes showing. And these areas that we identified were some of the top, not necessarily all of the top areas, but they were amongst the highest in the city. In addition to that, they were groups that they were areas that were really ethnically and racially diverse, had a lot of just diversity in age. We really wanted to go after a broad spectrum of people. And it also they were also areas that already had community partners working together. And that's a huge piece of this project, is that the community is actively involved in decisions and what we're doing. And so we wanted to work with areas where there are already these neighborhood groups working together, because it takes a long time to build those kinds of partnerships. And then we also wanted in areas that had a Eskenazi Health federally qualified community health center in them, because that's also a key partner for us.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about a new diabetes program here in Indianapolis that aims to reduce rates of the disease in three neighborhoods. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So, Alicia, if you would, talk to me about what this program is going to do. We know it's going to try to attack rates of diabetes, but the devil, I would think, is in the how.
Yeah. So what we have currently going is that we have two community health workers that are stationed at Forest Manor Health Center, Blackburn Health Center, and Westside Health Center. And what they're going to do is basically work with patients who have diabetes, who actually are that go to those specific health centers at those sites. And what they're going to do is help them with addressing what we call social determinants of health issues. So those things like food insecurity, if there are issues with patients able to ability to obtain healthy food, or even lack of transportation of getting to their appointments, if they have lack of health insurance. So we're going to be making sure that we appoint them to a financial counselor to help them get health insurance coverage. Other things that we would do as well is making sure that they are following their treatment plan and making sure that they are keeping up with those visits. So a lot of times with the doctors will want their patients to follow up every 3 months. And sometimes just with all of the different health issues that patients have going on, they may not be able to, they may have forgotten that, oh, I should have followed up in 3 months or 6 months, whatever the doctor have said. But we're going to be looking in their medical record to make sure that we, the patient knows what they're supposed to do, and helping them coordinate and get to those appointments. As well as also helping them establish their self-maintenance goals, whether they want to stop smoking, whether they want to start following that low-carb diet, whether they want to start an exercise plan, really helping them to coordinate a plan and say, what are the goals that you really want to work on, and how can we get there? What things that we can do to put together to meet their needs? They'll be working closely with the patients as well as seeing the patients in their home. So not only will they see them in the clinic, they will actually be able to go to their home and see the patients in the home.
Go ahead, Lisa.
So to add on that, this project is really doing everything from trying to do prevention mm-hmm. all the way through working mm-hmm. with patients who currently have diabetes, that we are trying to really do things like reduce the poor outcomes and reduce right. amputations and reduce those things. And that's yep. what Alicia was really talking about. But we also have other components where we're working with we know that there's a large percentage of the population that may already have diabetes and not mm. know it, and so they can't do anything to improve their quality of life, reduce their complications. And then there's another group who are pre-diabetic, who are mm-hmm. just at high risk, where if we do if we get them involved in physical activity, nutrition, a bunch of other things, we can potentially prevent the onset of diabetes for those folks. So we have another group of organizations that will be working and hiring a community health worker that are located within each of the communities. Those community health workers will be doing outreach, education, some screening to help those folks get connected to care or prevention resources, things like that. And then a third piece, which is a piece that we're really just getting started on, is really something around primary prevention, where we are working with the steering committees to identify what issue do we want to target. Do we want to target food access, because some of our areas don't have a lot of fresh fruits available, things like that. Things that are broader, that impact a lot of people, and that have the potential really to prevent diabetes in the long run. And so that's where we're going to get for the prevention piece. The others are improving care, quality of care, and reducing complications.
And I also, just to add, what I think is really important here is that the communities are drivers for a lot of these solutions. It's not Lilly or Eskenazi or Fairbanks coming in and saying, this is what you need to do. It's about communities who really know what they need, figuring out how they can improve lives for their residents. And we're really there to support them in that mission.
Where did the inspiration for this come, Tiffany?
So Lilly and the Lilly Foundation have been working for over two decades outside of the United States on a lot of partnerships to help communities. And we've done community health worker programs in all sorts of places, including India, sub-Saharan Africa, and Mexico. And what we've found is those community health worker programs have really helped people stay on a treatment plan, right? Someone comes to your house, it helps you make sure you don't miss appointments. Or if you miss appointments, it makes sure they check on you. It makes sure you have food access and all of these other things. And what we found is if you have a community health worker, it keeps people on a treatment plan. It helps them identify issues sooner, and it allows them to have long-term sustainable care. We've been doing that work everywhere around the globe for a really long time, and we said, why aren't we doing this here in our backyard? We know it works. We understand that all communities are different, and so there will be different things about what's happening here in Indianapolis, and we'll have different solutions, and we'll have different issues. But we know that model of connecting people to care in their own homes, in their own communities, makes an impact. So we thought it was really important to bring that model here right in our backyard.
Yeah, I was curious because the reason I asked the question is we had as a guest on this show, I guess about 3 months ago, Dr. Paul Farmer.
Yes.
From Partners in Health. I know he's worked with Lilly for years.
Very much so.
And is a tireless advocate for the community.
Absolutely.
Health organizer model. Was that part of the inspiration?
Absolutely. We've been working with Paul Farmer for a very long time, and the work he does and organizations like his work are inspirational. We can see where he has made aggressive changes to people's lives and to the communities where he's done work, and you can see actual health outcomes there for folks where they live longer lives, where they have improved health. And we just didn't understand why you can't do that here in Indianapolis with diabetes.
So, Patrice, this puts a certain amount of pressure on you, though, right? as the community contact person, how is that going to work for you?
Well, I think it's because it started from the beginning with allowing us to be at the table. Mm. That our entire community has taken a responsibility and a hold of this work, and we are all working together to make sure that it's accomplished. Whereas in some avenues, when we're working in community work, a community organizer has to kind of drag people along the way. But because the initial partners came to the table and said, "Now, what exactly do you want?" and they listened to everything that we asked for, even though we were really cocky when we came up with our expectations, and they actually provided those options with us, it makes it a lot easier for myself and other residents to really get on this process and move it through our community.
What sorts of things did you ask for?
One of the things we asked for was a longer term in the funding opportunity. Because we are a community that has received multiple funding programs, such as the Quality of Life Plan, LISC programs, it's usually a 1, 2, or 3 year process, which doesn't allow us to show great strides or changes. So when they came, we said we need more time. We also said that we needed to make sure that the individuals were within our community. If they're going to be hired in, they need to live or know our community 100%. They agreed to that and allowed that as well. And then we also asked for opportunities for residents to be a part of the stakeholders and be at the table and actually speak alongside of the funders. And that has happened in each of our neighborhoods, so that's why we have steering committees.
Go ahead, Lisa.
So I'd like to add to that because that was a wonderful process, and it – but I also echoes in my ears this, the statements that were made by the community partners were things like, don't come in and tell us how to eat healthy if there's no food, healthy food in the neighborhood. So be aware of what's happening in the neighborhoods before you come in and tell us what to do. We're not telling them what to do, but we're working together on that.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about a new program designed to reduce rates of diabetes in three Indianapolis neighborhoods. My guests are Dr. Lisa Staton, an associate professor at Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI, Patrice Duckett, a community organizer, Tiffany Benjamin, Lilly's senior director for corporate responsibility and global health, and Eskenazi nurse and clinical manager Alicia Jessup. If you want to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about a new program in three Indianapolis communities that aims to drive down high rates of diabetes. My guests are Dr. Lisa Staton, an associate professor at Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI, Patrice Duckett, a community organizer, Tiffany Benjamin, Lilly's senior director of corporate responsibility and global health, and Eskenazi nurse and clinical manager Alicia Jessup. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can track us down on Twitter at WFYI, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or do what a listener named Tyra has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Tyra writes, is anyone going to discuss the lack of access to fresh whole foods versus the large amount of fast food in these areas, or helping people to learn to cook with whole fresh foods? So Lisa's leaning in, so I think that's that one will go to her.
So that's a great question, and that's something that it's really important in all of our areas. You raised a lot of really critical points that there are parts of the city where there are lots of fast food options and no grocery stores, and lots of fast food options and no places to get fruits and vegetables. And then on the flip side, there are other parts of this areas that where there's really neither of those options. And so one of the things that we're hoping we're just starting our second year of this project, is to be focused on some of that and work on at the policy level and the systems level to try to improve access to that. There are already conversations around expanding farmers market options, working more and more with more urban gardens, things like that. So that's absolutely a critical need. I think in public health, we frequently do like to go and tell people how to eat because we think they don't know how. When you start to add all of the barriers to where am I going to buy it? Do I have to take a bus? How far is the bus? How far am I going to carry it? As well as we have lots of folks that have not grown up eating fruits and vegetables, and so it's not a common thing. And so if they buy it, it goes bad. And on a limited income, you don't have that luxury to waste that. So there's a lot of things that we will be working through and partnering with programs that are also providing nutritional education throughout the city, not reinventing the wheel, but expanding on things.
I'd like to ask the same question of all four of you and get all four, because, you know, part of the beauty of this discussion is that you're sort of dealing with this from four different points in the system. I'll start with Patrice, but what do you see as the biggest challenge in combating diabetes in these areas?
Well, I think right now it's education from our residents' perspective. So each one of our neighborhoods, the three neighborhoods that are a part of this program, are really active and engaged in the success of having grocery stores and quality food within their community. For instance, Near West works really closely with Kroger's to make sure that they are providing the right vegetables into their store. The Near Northwest area, which is my area, I have to keep saying that, is the Flanner House area. So we have now Flanner House Farms, and we're growing and opening up a bodega, which is a grocery store for our community that is community-based, community-voiced, and community-led. And then you also have on the northwest side where they advocated for a Save-A-Lot and other smaller grocery stores and a small farmer's market there, where they talk to those individuals, really advocate on what they need to change and what they need to have at those grocery stores and at the access points. Now, the second part to that is making sure that all of our residents understand that it may not look like a box grocery store, but it still provides great quality fresh vegetables, and you can use those fresh vegetables to have great quality meals. And so we have to work on that education process so they're not running to what we would consider kind of those box stores that do not provide that benefit for us, but they're really going to quality stores and farmer markets and farms to get their vegetables so that they have that at home when they're cooking.
Alicia, mm-hmm. Same question.
So same from my point of view, when we're working with the community health workers, we see front-facing all those social issues that are basically impacting their ability to get to the food or to buy the food. A lot of times, too, if our patients have less income, not enough, where they only have enough to really cover their rent, their utilities. A lot of times we're sending them to food pantries, which the foods there are high shelf life, so they're high in sodium, high in carbs. And so if they're wanting to follow a low-carb diet, that's something, too, that we always have to battle and say, okay, you know, what can we do? Is there any other programs that we can get you in, like Meals on Wheels? Or have you even applied for SNAP benefits? Do you even qualify for those? So a lot of times that is, we see all those social determinants of health issues and trying to figure out what is the why. And then taking it back to say, okay, here's what we can do. Here's how we can help you. But and then the second part of that, too, is the education piece, not really understanding their treatment plan. Mm-hmm. So most of the time, like, oh, yeah, I've heard that. And then a lot of times we'll say, okay, well, this is what this really means. You know, we'll ask, what do they think this, you know, what does that mean to them? And it's totally different from what maybe their doctor or their nurse has already displayed to them. So really educating them on, you know, what do my numbers mean? What does it mean when I go and get my A1C checked every 3 months? What do those numbers mean when my sugar is saying that, you know, the meter is reading that it's 300 or my A1C
means it's
is 14?
Good. I know that.
Right. And that, a lot of times they do it, know it's not good, but just really even knowing what are the complications and getting them, even community health workers, connecting them back to the sites, to their providers, and the nurses there to do that heavy lifting education to say, you know, this patient really truly doesn't understand what's going on with their care.
Tiffany.
Yeah, I think we have a great public-private partnership. And so I think the biggest thing we have to do is sort of to Patrice's earlier point, ensure that this is long term. Right. So if we do this right, this program can be scalable and it can go anywhere, which is one of the values of having three different neighborhoods that look demographically very different. But it requires all of the partners to come together and create sustainable solutions. So awareness, but pulling on many different levers. Right. So we were just talking about food, but also treatment and care, medication, all of these different components. So getting all of those variables to work together for a sustained period of time strikes me as probably the biggest challenge.
Lisa.
And I would add on all of those is that what we are looking at is trying to look at health in a broader way, not just, you know, here's the fix, here's treatment, and understanding and being able to address how complicated each person's challenges are, and how do we make help with the community to create this healthier environment so that healthier behaviors are, to be cliche, the easier choice, the easiest choice. And so really trying to address everything and figuring out how do we do everything at once is, to me, our biggest challenge.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about an innovative new program aimed at reducing rates of diabetes in three Indianapolis neighborhoods. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. So what it seems to me we keep coming back to a couple of things. One, that this has to be longstanding. And is that, Patrice, I'm going to throw it to you as sort of the voice of the community here. Was that the sort of major trust point that had to be dealt with? And I know from years of reporting that is one of the resistances you get with neighborhoods is that they're tired of the mm-hmm. Lone Ranger approach. Somebody rides in and then rides back out.
Yeah, we have a saying where you shouldn't do to us, but you have to do with us.
Yeah.
And so it has, over the last couple of years, we have, and those three neighborhoods have been disenfranchised in so many different ways. And the main thing is that we're going to come in and provide this quick program for you, and it's going to work, but you have to do this within a year. You have to put this plan together within 6 months, and then you have to activate it within 7 months. Well, in that 7 months, our whole community can change within seconds. And so they have to give us enough patience and time to really move with the flow of our community. And then as the flow of the community changes, so does the trust. And as long as they know that you're there for the long call, then they will put more investment in your efforts so that their efforts is long term. Because in the end, if you run out within that first year, you're not doing them any justice but wasting their time. And that's one thing that they don't have enough time. You know, we don't have enough time for that. So we need to make sure that the longer you're here, the more we can work together and you're not just doing to us.
Tiffany, I'm going to ask this question of everybody, too. How are you going to define success with this?
I think we'll see numbers, right? So we'll see improvements in hopefully the reduction in the incidence. We'll see more people in long-term treatment. I think one of the really exciting things about this project and why it matters that IU Fairbanks is involved is because there's a data collection component of this, right? So we're going to spend a lot of time in this project figuring out what worked, what didn't work. We're going to test the data, and then we're going to share it. So there will be a lot of different ways that we can measure success. And then it's not just whether we measure success by having achieved a goal in these three neighborhoods, but if we've measured success and been able to say, here's something we can package and take anywhere else and maybe put it in other communities. So we basically start a movement of changing how people live and how they treat their diabetes and reducing the incidence in communities all around the state.
Alicia, same question mm-hmm. to you. How are you going to define success for this?
Success looks like for me is improved health outcomes. So, you know, those A1Cs that are greater than 9% that we're actually controlled, we're at 7, you know, I'll take 8. If you're at 9%, I'll take you going down to an 8, but at least that they're controlled at with their A1C being 7%. Also, those fewer hospitalizations, those less ED visits, that they're really complying with their treatment plan. So when the doctor says come back in 3 months, we have more patients coming back and seeing the provider every 3 months and getting the care that they're supposed to get. And then also just connecting those who have issues with transportation, food access, that we're really connecting them and then that they're actually making an effort to be able to connect themselves to those resources. So that once we tell them what the resources are and get them connected, that they're able to do that on their own. So that's what success looks like to me.
Mm-hmm. Lisa?
So one of the exciting things about this project to me is that we have so many different partnerships, and some of them are on this panel, but we also have a partnership with LISC, a community development organization, which is a non-traditional public health kind of partner. We have partnerships with the Marion County Health Department. We have partnerships with a lot of different organizations. And I say that because one of our goals all along the way is that everything we're creating with the eye of how is that sustained internally and not just needing more grant funding. And because that's what happens with a lot of initiatives is we do something great, it works, but now we need to get another grant to make that work. And so our whole goal with Eskenazi Health is making sure that we create something that works within them, within their system, to be sustainable after the funding goes away for this project. But we also are working with that on all of the different components. So for me, success at the long term is that we've got something set up that's holistic in that it's not just doing one thing, but that it's going after all different levels and that we've got a sustainability, that it'll be sustained in the community and the community is excited to keep it going. So plus we'll have lots of data. And I do want to caution everybody, 5 years is a short time for diabetes outcomes. And with a lot of what we're doing, honestly, what we can expect to see initially are increases in diabetes rates because we'll be screening more folks and things. But my goal, my hope is that by the end of the 5 years, we'll start to see that flattening and then eventually see that dip.
Patrice, you get the last word on this round.
All right. So we see it from a community's perspective a little differently. So one thing that we will see is the perception of community and funder partnerships. So being able to be at the table, really having a stake on what is needed to change our community. We're hoping that after the 5 years or so, they get other individuals get to see how this helps and how really having individuals at the table can really make a difference. The other thing is education and awareness. So in my community, it may not be about numbers, but it may be that our grocery stores are starting to pick up, that people are coming to the farm and they're actually using the fresh vegetables and they're changing their lifestyle. So it's more of a healthier lifestyle, which is hard to count quantitatively. And then the last thing is changing our life expectancy rate, our dates. So I live in a community where I am more likely to die 10 years before the individuals that live in Monon Trail. And so that hits hard because I have children that I have to raise in my community, and I need that number to diminish, and I need to be able to live in my house in my community and be happy that I live there and not fearful that I may have to be out of here before I'm 70.
We've gotten a couple of questions from a listener, a couple of listeners now, about how they could get involved, either, you know, if they live in one of these areas and they want to try to access the services, how do they go about doing that? And then another one from a listener who says, is there any way to be involved as a volunteer in terms of helping this? So I don't know who to pitch that one to. Lisa?
I think okay. I'll take that. So the best way to do that is we do have a website that has a nice fillable form that can have somebody fill out your information, and we will get back to you. Our website, you can get to it by going to diabetes.iupui.edu.
Go ahead and give that to them again.
Diabetes.iupui.edu. And you will go into there and you'll find the dip in. We fondly call our project Dip In. And so you can fill out that form. Let us know if you're a resident of that area. That'll trigger a whole bunch of other things. But also, if you're just interested in volunteering, we will follow up with you.
Is there any way for people to connect? I mean, there still is a digital divide, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who likely would need these services but don't have access to a computer or the internet. What's the best way for them to contact or get involved?
So I would say maybe I could toss this to Patrice because it's the personal connections within the community and community organizations.
Okay, Patrice.
So I think the first thing will be to reach out to your community center that's in that area. So for the Northwest area, you have Flinner House. And if you want to get engaged or even see the access or opportunities that you may have for this program, is to reach out to Flinner House and let them know that you're interested in a diabetes program and speak with Ms. Rhonda. In the Near West area, you can reach out to Crystal Moore House or also Hawthorne Community Center, and they can provide you with the same information. And in the Near East side, you can reach out to the Marion County Health Department and speak to Ms. Sonia, and she can provide you with information and get you connected as well. And I think reaching out to Eskenazi is another opportunity.
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead, Alicia.
For the Eskenazi Health Center, so if you're a patient at Blackburn Health Center, you can contact the health center 317-931-4300 ask them about the program and let them know that you want to try to get connected with a community health worker, and then they can get that information to you and get you connected to one of those community health workers. For Forest Manor Health Center, it's 317-541-3400.
Go ahead and give that again.
Mm-hmm. 317-541-3400, and that's Forest Manor Health Center. For Westside Health Center, it is 317-554-4600.
Again, please.
317-554-4600 for Westside Health Center.
If you are just joining us, we're talking about an innovative program to try to bring down rates of diabetes in three Indianapolis communities. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Dr. Lisa Staton. She is an associate professor at Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI. Patrice Duckett, a community organizer. Tiffany Bedge, Benjamin, who is Senior Director of Corporate Responsibility and Global Health at Lilly, and Eskenazi Nurse and Clinical Manager, Alicia Jessup. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, Director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking today about a new program that is designed to reduce rates of diabetes in three Indianapolis communities. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881, find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can send us an email, as a listener named Wesley has done, at nolimits@wfyi.org. I'm going to direct the question to my guest, Dr. Lisa Staton, an associate professor at Fairbanks School of Public Health at IUPUI, Patrice Duckett, a community organizer, Tiffany Benjamin, who is Senior Director of Corporate Responsibility and Global Health at Lilly, and Eskenazi Nurse and Clinical Manager Alicia Jessup. Wesley writes, "Can you work with the box stores to stop throwing their food out? America ranks among the worst countries in the world for food waste. There is a company called Under the Sun Market trying to solve trying to solve the food insecurity epidemic in Indianapolis. They're located at 38th and Illinois." I see Patrice nodding her head, so I'm going to go with you first on that one.
Yeah, we're definitely familiar with that process and the opportunity to try to save some of our food, especially in our food areas that are more like food swamps, which are more fast food than grocery stores. So as a community center and a community organizer, one of the things is just getting the awareness out to those box stores and really building that relationship as residents and community partners and helping them move that that opportunity. So it is something that we've been talking about in our neighborhood.
I'm going to ask an uncomfortable question, but I think it's got to be asked in this context. I mean, is there a ceiling to these efforts without significant investment, particularly in creating food options and all of that, grocery stores, in these communities? I mean, as we've discussed, there's some places not only where there aren't fresh food options, there aren't even fast food options. There are not food options, period. And we're talking about people who have very limited means. We'll start with Lisa on that one, but I want to hear Patrice. I want to hear everyone's thoughts on that, because this is, that seems to me to be the wall you've got to climb.
So it's a huge huge challenge. I think you hit a huge issue. But what I would like to point out is our neighborhood in the Northeast was one of those areas that didn't have a grocery store. And after multiple years of the community coming together with partners to look at plans and really work out a plan on how to encourage a grocery store to come in. They have now got a Save-A-Lot after the last couple years. So I would say it's not a ceiling, but it's definitely a high bar and a long challenge, and it's not a quick fix, which is why these projects can't come in and do a one-year project, because there's no way we will make changes at the environmental level like that in 1 or 2 years. It's got to be a long-term plan to make it happen. But I think it can happen.
Tiffany, same question to you. I mean, is there a way to do this without significant investment in these communities?
I mean, I think your point is valid that it's a challenge. But I think what's important about this movement or the Dip-In project is, frankly, that it's got a lot of different partners. And so the thing that makes it doable here is that you've got Eskenazi involved, you got Fairbanks involved, the Marion County Health Department is here, Lilly as a company is involved, and then you've got people in the community who are leading these steering committees saying this is what we need. And so I think it might be impossible if you just asked one actor or one person to do it, but the fact that this is so collaborative, your listeners are asking how they can participate. If you have enough people and enough organizations that are willing to center around it, it's definitely possible. And what we've definitely seen in this last year is a lot of enthusiasm in the community to participate, to help, to build, and to grow, and that makes it 100% possible.
Alicia.
Yep. Just to piggyback on what they said, I mean, I really think it's just doing this work for 5 years, it's possible. I mean, the barriers are great because sometimes we'll go in, you know, to help this patient in the community or that patient, and while the issues are the same, some of the there's still differences in each person's circumstance. But when we get the community partners and even like the health center, everyone working together, I think it comes easier to tackle when we have partners all working together for the same goal of helping the patient. So I think that it does take time, and I'm thankful for this, you know, this period that we have 5 years to really work on and tackle these issues. But I think, you know, the biggest thing is connecting us all together, all of us community partners, even down to our patients or the, you know, people who live in the neighborhood, and everyone working together. I think we could tackle it together.
Patrice, are you going to be the... the voice of the contrarian here, because there's a part there's a part of me that that when I hear this, it makes me think, you know, if there aren't those options within in the community and all of that, I mean, it's sort of like saying, okay, you're a bird. Well, I can flap my arms all day long, mm-hmm. but it's still not going to allow me to fly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the reality is unless some of those fundamental things change.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a ceiling that is there. It's a glass ceiling, so it can easily be broken. But it does take four components to make that happen. And the first thing is community. So the community has to be engaged, and they have to be active, and they have to know their power to be able to speak on what they need to change. And then they need major partners that are alongside of us that can help us with those movements that we cannot afford to do, and that it helps to diminish some of the disparities that are there, that are right in our face, that it takes some time. It takes city officials to really look at how do they fund, and how do they look at their budget, and how do they advocate for our communities. So many times in our those three neighborhoods, our community is looked over, looked around, and possibly just passed over until it becomes beneficial for the developer. And it has to change with that city official in order for us as a community to change as well. And then the last piece, which is our biggest piece that has to be there, is political leadership and policy change. If we do not change our policies within our communities, within our state, then this will continue to happen. We are very happy and glad that we have this project in our communities. And granted, you know, we're not here just because of the money, but we see the importance of having such large partners at our table to help us with that next step of leverage to get us to that glass ceiling, so that we can start cracking that, so that it changes for the long term, and it changes for my children and for my grandchildren.
We have received an email from a listener, and again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. And this listener writes, as published in the American Journal of Lifestyle Medicine, the numbers tell us that 75% of the $2.8 trillion in annual health care costs in the United States is due to chronic diseases that can be prevented or even reversed by a whole food, plant-based, vegan lifestyle. Beans, rice, lentils, potatoes should be the staple. Easy to cook, cheap. Frozen vegetables are often better than not so fresh. Frozen are picked, then frozen immediately, which lock in nutrients. Avoid meat, dairy, and oil. Low carb is a killer. Alicia, as the RN, I probably will let you take that one.
So, I definitely, you know, agree that, you know, as far as the foods and things that, you know, better food, it creates better health outcomes. The thing, too, where we, with doing this work, the patients, too, also have to make change. So, again, if they come up from where they were raised that, you know, well, mom cooked this that was, you know, high in fat. And so then that's what they learned to start cooking instead of the healthier options. So it's almost to breaking down that cycle to say, okay, you know, if I do have the access to get the foods and the healthier options, that I want to make that change and actually do it. But again, what we see too a lot of with healthcare, patients say, you know what, I want to eat this, or again, it's sometimes even linked to stress. They stress eat, and so they don't eat the healthier options because, again, it's not always, they say, well, it doesn't taste as good as the piece of cake or the soda or, you know, the fried food or the fast food. So I think from my standpoint of it, too, is while I agree, you know, the healthier options can help prevent some or promote healthier lifestyles, I think, too, our patients and everyone individually, me as well, have to make that change to say that I want to do better and I want to follow this healthier diet and lifestyle.
Go ahead, Lisa.
And I would say, and it's about promoting baby steps towards that, because if the diet is dramatically different than what people are used to eating, and this is what Alicia is saying too, is that people are not going to make. Not everybody's going to make a dramatic change, but we can help them move towards baby steps that eventually their diet looks a little different and is more nutritious. So that's a big challenge.
Tiffany. Well,
and I'd say there's also a skill component of this. If you hand me a squash, I don't know how to cook that. We have to be realistic about the fact that if you didn't come up cooking a certain thing, you don't have the skills to know how to do that. So you have to also give people the space to learn. And so I think that's why the point about education is really important here and awareness. So it's about baby steps, but it's also giving people the opportunity because sometimes you just don't know.
Is that the, you know, we've talked about sort of the macro challenges, is that the biggest micro one of dealing, you know, and I know, as I disclosed at the beginning of the program, I'm diabetic myself. And, you know, I've never been a crack addict or anything like that, but I cannot imagine it could be all that much more difficult than giving up processed sugar. Was after, you know, I'd been pouring a couple of tons of it over my taste buds every year to surrender that. Is that where, you know, at the human level, most of the resistance occurs? Patrice, you're looking at me, so I'm going with you first, but then.
Well, I'm unsure, but I can definitely speak on my behalf as far as a resident within this area. When we look at how do we change that lifestyle and how do we get to that point. And, you know, I'm a single mom. I have two children. I work 50 plus hours a week. It is very hard for me, even with me advocating around this work. My mother is diabetic, actually has had two kidney transplants. And I know how important it is to eat healthy. However, I still work tons of hours and my kids are in tons of different activities. The time is just not there. And I need to know how to get to that point. So education and understanding and looking at my social deterrents and saying, okay, this is how we can make this work for your situation and taking those baby steps, I think is more beneficial. And I'm a Mountain Dew drinker. And so, yes, it's almost like, I don't know, it's an addiction that other. So we have to be very patient with this work because it's not just me. There's, you know, gas stations at every one of our corners. In Hallville, there's 10 gas stations within a 5-mile radius that sells nothing but sugar and these, you know, unhealthy drinks. So there's a lot of things that we have to change. We just can't flip the switch and say we're going over to healthy eating and then everyone is going to jump on board. Because you also have to think about the pain, the headaches, the withdrawals that come along with that, and who wants to go through that, right? Mm-hmm.
And go ahead,
I'm
Lisa.
Sorry, and just to add, the emotional eating that was mentioned too, you know, that's all part of that package.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Alicia.
Yeah. I mean, I 100% agree. It sounds easy when you say it, but it's very hard. And, you know, like a lot of patients, like what we deal with, they'll say, you know, I don't even know how to start. Like I tried to give up, you know, these sweets today. But then by the end of the day, I had to have it again because again, like the withdrawal symptoms. So like even with us, what I teach the community health workers is to say, okay, if you know you have 3 meals per day, try 1 meal, give up something for 1 meal. You know, if you know that you're going to have that big piece of cake or you're going to be celebrating or you have to have that Mountain Dew, don't drink it 3 or 4 times per day. Can we give it up? The ultimate goal is to stop drinking it. But again, it's those baby steps. Can we say today I'm only going to drink 2 as opposed to four. So it's really working out that plan with them to say, what can you commit to and what is your confidence level? We always do that. We always do a rating scale to say from a scale of 0 to 10, how confident are you willing to change? If they score 7 or more, the confidence is higher that they potentially would. But if it's under 7, we're still working to say, what would it take for you to get to 7 or more? It's that behavioral interviewing that we really do to coach our community health workers to help with impacting change with patients.
Tiffany, how quickly do you expect to see this program having some impact in these communities?
So there's impact and there's impact, right? So as I think everybody said, it's going to take a long time to see health outcomes increase dramatically. So we have to be patient when we look at that to see, are we going to reduce the incidence of diabetes? But if you ask me about impact in the small eye, I would say already, right? The partnership around this table is impact. What Patrice talked about in the fact that we have a level of trust amongst all of the different partners who have different perspectives and different viewpoints is impact. That will make a huge impact on our community. It will make a huge impact on our ability to partner in a whole host of different ways. And it will really have a huge impact on our ability to be successful in the long run and to show people that this is possible. So to me, we're almost to our year anniversary, and I already see a whole host of impact.
Have you seen the numbers move at all?
We haven't seen the numbers yet. We're too early.
What numbers, and I should have asked earlier, what numbers are you collecting? Lisa?
So we are collecting a whole lot of different things. But honestly, the first year has been about partnership building and creating some baseline information. And so we have just started. The community health workers have just come on board out of Eskenazi over the last 2 or 3 weeks seeing clients. So we can't expect to see anything yet. But we are gathering information about everything from hospitalizations through what's the process so that we can document that package at the end that says this is how the community health workers worked at Eskenazi, or this is how the community health workers worked at our neighborhood association, so that we have that model at the end. So we're gathering information, everything from the individual of the clients touched by the community health workers to more community level changes that are happening, that are looking at shifts in what's the food environment look like in each neighborhood? What does the physical activity environment look like in each neighborhood?
So we're getting close on time, almost at the end of the program. If people do want to access the services, again, Patrice, through the community health centers, how should they go, or community centers, how should they do that? And then I hope we're going to have time to go to Alicia real quickly.
So you can reach for the Northwest, you can go to Flanner House and ask for Rhonda. For the Near West, you can go to Christmore House or Hawthorne Center and let them know that you're interested in Dip In. And then for the Near East, you can go over to the Marion County Health Department and ask for Sonia.
Alicia?
Mm-hmm. For the health centers, Blackburn Health Center, you can call and let them know that you're interested in the Dip In program. And it's 317-931-4300. Again, 317-931-4300. Force Manor, 317-541-3400. And Westside, 317-554-4600.
That will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.